Welcome to the Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, or perhaps one of our greatly appreciated radio syndicates across the country, or maybe find us on the podcast, which can be found anywhere podcasts can be found, including now with the Harbinger Media Network. Check them out if you have not. My name is Stephen Hostetter, and I am joined, as per usual, by Lauren Latour, and specially joined in our once a month special episode to break down all things in the world energy by Mitchell Beer from the Energy Mitch, Energy Mix.
Thanks for having me back again, Stefan. And I'm Lauren. We get to be on the same call at the same time for the first time. This is fantastic.
This is great.
Last time, we mentioned that if people send us carrier pigeons, we would answer their questions. And a listener heard our call and sent us what they called a virtual carrier pigeon, which I'm going to accept, with three distinct questions. And so we're going to try to tackle them all in this first segment before our second segment, which is three stories that we have pulled from the energy mix that we thought were particularly interesting. And then, as we always finish on the show, with a special segment of issues near and dear to Mitchell's heart. But before we get there, we will dive in to this first listener question, which comes from a listener named Phil. So thank you so much, Phil. It's really actually just to talk about prefab housing. We mentioned it, I think, last time on the show about ways that prefab housing could allow for retrofits at scale, but the listener's hoping for a deeper dive. So what can you tell us?
First of all, I really want to commend, praise the listener for getting this to us via virtual carrier pigeon. I think there has to be room for all kinds of carrier pigeons on this show. It's really important to make clear that no live carrier pigeons were harmed or disturbed in the making of these questions. So really nicely done. And everyone, please keep following that precedent. So starting with prefab housing, the question had to do specifically with building passive house style homes. So these are very highly energy efficient, low energy, low carbon homes for social housing. So they're affordable and getting them made out of prefabricated components. The basic concept is that what have been called prefab housing, manufactured housing, it's in many ways more efficient to produce, more efficient rather than to create the sustained and the faster supply of housing that we need, not only to meet the affordable housing challenges that we're hearing about, you know, in every daily headline you see these days, and rightly so, but also the supply of low carbon, zero carbon, zero carbon ready housing. Refabricating as many of the components as possible speeds up the work, it speeds up the process, it gets the houses on the ground faster, it's easier to standardize many of the components. It's an approach that has had a long history. The conversation, until we began hearing more about prefab, when you heard about manufactured housing years and decades ago, it was the same thing. And needless to say, custom builders hated it. It was partly because it was competition for them just getting their crews out on the ground and building houses the way we all imagine when we think of a house being built. It was also seen somehow as a lesser kind of housing. I can't speak for sure to whether that was the case then, but I can say that it's not the case now. And given the combined urgency of affordable housing and low energy, low carbon housing, and both the need and also the moment of opportunity we're in to knit those two together, if there was a stigma against this kind of housing, it's really time for that stigma to collapse and begin getting prefab in place, both for new and also for energy retrofits. The really important thing to remember about housing, which accounts for about 13% of Canada's climate pollution and 40% or more in some urban areas, the thing to remember is that most of the homes, most of the buildings of all kinds that will be with us in 2050 are already with us now. So while the emphasis we've been hearing lately has been about new housing, and necessarily so, deep energy retrofits, renovations are going to be extremely important over the next 10 to 15 to 20 years. And there's a concept from Europe called Energy Sprung, which uses prefabricated components not only to bring existing buildings to or close to a net zero standard, but Energy Sprung producers have found a way to get large numbers of homes done, essentially by building a better system around the process, taking the need to manage the project and fund the project up front out of the hands of the building occupant, the building owner, if it's a public housing agency, and the owner of multiple units. And all of this is oriented toward meeting this monumental challenge of basically getting every building that's going to be with us in 2050 and is already here, getting all of those buildings retrofitted to a D deep, low energy, low carbon standard as fast as we can.
Listener, I hope that answers your question. If you have further follow-up questions about passive housing, I'm sure we could talk about it all day. And we could also reach out to other guests to see if the other people have a thought. So if any specific questions on that, please do send them our way. Pivoting to question number two, and it's an Ottawa-specific question. So Lauren, you may have additional interest on this one. Before I read the question, let me try to explain the technology that's being referenced here. One of the many ways buildings are heated and cooled is to run water through pipes and into units that then disperse the preferred temperature. In most traditional setups, water is heated using a boiler and cooled using a technology that's similar to fridges. And the energy needed to heat and cool these buildings is a major source of emissions that buildings are often responsible for. So to address this, many places are beginning to explore using nearby water sources as a heat sink to cool the water naturally by running pipes underground and into the body of water. The body of water is much colder than the water that's being run. That water cools down and then is pumped back into the buildings and used for cooling. In Toronto, and this is being used a lot of places. In Toronto, there are 180 buildings that are currently being cooled by water from Lake Ontario using this system. The concern from the listener is that while each individual project might not raise the temperature of the river in a way that's concerning, it's possible that the cumulative effect of too many buildings using the same body of water as a heat sink could have a negative impact on the ecosystem. But let me ensure that I ask this question exactly as they put it by reading their words. I am becoming aware of more projects investing into heat and cooling exchanger technology using rivers as a sink. That is obviously great as a low carbon resource. However, having studied environmental law in a different country, pollution is often defined as the negative impact on an ecosystem or legal subject. So if several projects lined up along a river, then the river's wastewater temperature is likely to increase in the summer. Environmental impact assessments might not be triggered due to the size of each individual project, say one office tower, but a cumulative effect might not be caught by legislation. This problem is exacerbated if low water-carrying rivers have less capacity to dilute the undesired polluting heat. I think this will be a lot more of a problem even in our water-rich nation, as last year's Colorado River / Hoover Dam tragedy seems to repeat itself. This person's not against the green technology, but they do wonder about this cumulative impact and how it could happen. So in your research and looking into this, Mitchell, what'd you come up to?
Yeah, thanks. I think it's a really interesting question and a really timely one. We're at the point now where much of the country is in or on its way into drought. Much of North America, as you mentioned, the Colorado River, which has been drying out in our lifetimes, and the Hoover Dam, which is in serious trouble at this point, and in Canada as well. We are hearing that actually hydropower supplies, hydroelectric power in BC, Manitoba, and I believe Quebec is coming in at lower quantities than expected just because of a loss of water flow. So this is a very real and current issue. Rivers around Ottawa, I've seen a couple of proposals and I've heard mixed opinions on what, if any, impact those projects will have. And I don't think there's any real clear-cut answer at this point, except to say that you're absolutely right, the listener's absolutely right, about cumulative impact. In so many areas, we'll see a single project brought in, and, it doesn't pass the threshold. So what's the problem? Let's just get this project done. Then a second one comes along that's still the same attitude, and that cumulative assessment is not done when it needs to be. So that just brings us back to the basic principles for any project of any kind, digging down into the details, listening to communities, where people are probably often already digging into those details because it's, our own home turf where this is happening. And being as anticipatory as we can, it's called the precautionary principle for a reason, to ensure that impacts are understood, that impacts are at very least minimized. And that if it's serious enough, you don't go ahead with the project. A conversation that I've been hearing so often in the climate and energy community is that, yes, on one hand, we are up against this massive global deadline to drastically reduce our emissions. And not the whole answer, but one part of the answer is to change out technologies and to substitute renewable for non-renewables, to substitute electricity for for fuels, especially for fossil fuels. The counter to that is that, frankly, if all we're about is taking one set of crappy, corrupt technologies and replacing them with another one, you know, and all we do is move around where the communities are making sacrifices to allow this stuff to happen, I think most of us who are involved in this work are trying to achieve something better than that. And we should expect that the communities where those projects are supposed to take place are going to expect something better, and rightly so. We're in a moment where there is already massive pushback in many places to the solar, wind, battery storage projects that are so self-evident to anybody who's focused just strictly on climate from the top down, who's focused strictly on energy transition from the top down, as opposed to, okay, wait a minute, this battery plant is going to take out a wetland. This wind farm is right near a protected area. You know, and I'm not going to geolocate those, but each of those is a project. I could tell you about a proposed wind farm in a Canadian province that was in a Francophone area, and the developers thought it would go just fine if they went in with unilingual English materials. I mean, you can script how that turned out, and it's an unforced error. So keeping communities front and center and right at the top of these processes is the first step to making it work, and it's got to be.
I feel like there's been such a failure to really begin to engage communities as being a main part of the solution. I've become obsessed a little bit in my brain in the last like few months with the idea of how invisible we try to make climate solutions, at least have in the, especially the Canadian federal government has like really heavily invested in like the, we'll just do the innovation on the outsides, or we'll have a price on carbon, which again, good policy, but tries to make the solutions invisible to people. It's like we're scared that people might be mad about any climate action, and therefore we try not to talk about it, but that only breeds resentment and distrust. I've been harping on the show forever, but it's like, I'm not going to take a climate plan seriously in this country unless it includes an intercity bus network. We've sort of allowed for other stories to get told because we're not doing proper engagement with the communities that are being infected.
Somebody mentioned to me that you know, years and maybe decades ago, project developers would, you know, just sort of go into a community with a government relations officer and figure the job was done. Now this person was saying, it's so much better. We're sending in community relations people as well. To which I would say, okay, so far so good. That's a quantum improvement if you're not just sending the GR person to, you know, try to help people figure things out. But there are different ways of doing community relations. You can go in with the assumption that you're actually there to listen and that, you know, in theory or in practice, you'll stay there as long as it takes to really get it and really understand concerns and modify the project to the extent possible if necessary. Or you're just going in to check the box so that you can tell the regulator that you consulted, which is the experience we've had with the oil and gas and the pipeline and the nuclear industries. And how has that worked? And why would we expect it to work any better for, quote unquote, our technologies? I spent way too many years in the meetings and events industry as a conference publisher. We often worked alongside facilitators, and we could spot at a mile's distance or a kilometer's distance the ones who had consulted with the client to figure out what outcome they wanted before they actually talked to any real folk. And we could tell because the process wasn't working. And we could see the facilitators who really meant it, that this was about listening and empowering communities. It ain't rocket science. If it were, I promise you, I wouldn't be able to articulate it. But too often, project developers, for whatever reason, sometimes the regulatory process won't allow them to actually talk to the community until it's been selected. Sometimes the competitive process around private projects won't permit that. So we can understand the reasons for it, but the bottom line is we have to fix it. Because if we don't, we'll just be in for a world of problems that we don't have time to solve, when ultimately we need to get projects done fast and emissions driven down quickly in a way that doesn't sacrifice communities.
Speaking of rocket science, the third question.
I know where you're going.
Which is the bonus question from our listener, is about sustainable jet fuel. Got any bets on that outside of not flying? I have mine, but I'm stealing mine from Ministry of the Future. So what do you got, Mitchell?
Well, I would love to know how the listener put together prefab housing, the precautionary principle around river temperatures and sustainable aviation fuels in one email, but it was a brilliant email. And thank you once again. I don't have very much confidence in any sustainable jet fuel at this point. It's not my main specialty. I don't spend all my time reading about it. But what I have found whenever I've tried to dig into it is that it is so hard to separate the spin from the substance, to identify anything that's actually ready for prime time as opposed to ready for a whole bunch of additional subsidized research, and to find providers, or for that matter, technologies that are really about genuine emission reductions as opposed to carbon offsets and greenwash. And that's a very general statement on my part. I may well be selling short the one great solution that's out there. And, you know, we just need to listen better at the energy mix. I'm completely open to that argument. But from anything I've seen so far, the solutions are not ready for now. They're certainly not ready to contribute to emissions reduction targets. And part of the problem is that the aviation industry itself, international aviation in particular, does not instill confidence. And I'm not just talking about Boeing falling out of the sky at every opportunity. I can take you back to the Paris conference, COP21 in 2015, when the international aviation and international marine shipping industries spent the whole 2 weeks lobbying like mad to get left out of the Paris Agreement, just as they were left out of the Kyoto Protocol before it, which means that in the Paris Agreement, there are no direct targets for aviation emission reductions, even though they're rising faster than most other sources, from a smaller base, but rising faster. They succeeded, and they were left out. And at the end of the conference, you know, within, I remember it as hours, it might have been a couple of days, time was compressing for everybody at that point, but within a couple of hours or a couple of days, didn't both international associations issue nearly identical news releases saying, oh, that's so sad. It's really too bad. I guess it's up to us now because the delegates couldn't agree what to do about us. The delegates were lobbied within an inch of their lives, at least metaphorically, not to do anything about it. And the industry has been delaying and delaying and holding things off ever since. So that doesn't really give any sense that they're terribly interested in sustainable aviation fuels in anything that would come from their engineering department as opposed to their PR office. And we don't need stuff that just comes from their PR office. One part of the listener's question was, is this just about not flying? I would say that it's about flying less. Backing that up, I'll say something a little bit controversial. And that is that I know so many people, I have the conversation quite often with folks who are just agonizing about that one flight every year or every 2 years or every 4 years. You know, and sometimes it'll be, you know, my daughter is graduating in Europe. Can I go to Scotland by air? You know, do I dare? Am I violating every principle if I do that? And when I hear that kind of question, frankly, my answer is book the flight. Buy an offset won't do anything, but buy an offset if it makes you feel better. But book the flight. You're not a frequent flyer. You're not a private jet flyer. And that's where the lion's share of the impacts from that industry are coming from. It's not to say we should all go nuts and be profligate about our air travel. Anytime climate solutions come around to, oh, if we just do our bit as individuals, everything will be fine. It's a system problem. You know, not that we can't make our own individual impact, but it's a system problem. And that's where we need to put our attention and our energy. And in air travel, it's the private jets. It's the people who spend 200, you know, parts of 200 days out of the year in the air. It's the meeting and event industry, which was essentially born. And again, as a former meetings person, the industry was essentially born as a stepchild of hospitality and aviation. And the original operating principle was originally heads in beds, bums in seats. So that was the hotel and the plane. And at one point, the World Tourism Organization, I believe, decided to address the question of whether the international aviation industry was so dependent on meetings and events that they couldn't exist without it, that they wouldn't have a business case without it. They concluded that they would be okay without meetings and events, but it was a close enough thing that they had to ask the question. So ask yourself again, does that one flight that you're planning to take make that much difference? If there's a more efficient way to get there, of course, go for it. But if it's the only day in the known history of the universe when your daughter's going to be graduating in Scotland, be there with her.
If you want to ask how you can find a way to let yourself fly less or decrease air emissions, one of the number one ways is physical ground infrastructure, right? Like the reason France could ban short-haul flights is because of how good their high-speed rail network is, that they can just say, no, take the train. You just don't get to do this anymore. And that's not a thing we can say here in Canada at all. You can't even get to half the cities without some type of privatized transportation, whether or not it's a car or a plane. So my half-joking answer from Ministry of the Future is blimps. Bring back the blimps. It's how that book solves aviation and also destroys all regular air passenger flights. But the book is remarkably pro-ecoterrorism. I'll say this again. It's truly remarkably pro-ecoterrorism. But I'll just echo one last thing you said before we'll go to music break, Mitchell. I spent a number of my years in the sort of tech accelerators for climate solutions. And one of the things, every once in a while, someone would try to bring up a new sustainable aviation fuel. And nothing is moving fast enough in that right now at all. And I think the reason why you can tell that is because we don't even, as people who stay really connected to this, there's not even like a top three in my brain, right? Like, it's not like if you ask me how we're going to decarbonize freight travel, I actually have some answers to that question because we're far enough along to have some good answers to that question. And the question is like, which technology will win? Air travel is so much further behind than that. And despite the billions of dollars that you've heard it get pumped into it. And so, yeah, I don't think we're that close.
I guess the only other point is, at one point, I haven't heard anything about this for a little while, but at one point I was hearing a notion of necessary aviation, okay? And it's more self-evident for freight, but it works for passenger as well, that if the donor organ is in Amsterdam and the recipient is in Vancouver, and we've decided as a society that that's something we're going to do, then not only would I say, send the donor organ by air, but if you're sending the plane loaded at the gills with stuff on standby so that you're making best use of the footprint of that plane flying. On the other hand, if the cut flowers are in Amsterdam and the market is in New York City and they have to be there by morning because longer story of why the United States killed off its domestic flower industry at one point, that's kind of like the definition of insanity. And if you were to go through an inventory, the things that make sense to do, and the things that don't make sense to do, and have some criteria for, you know, what would it take to justify the footprint of this kind of flight every year for the UN climate conference, you know, like clockwork, beginning about 3 weeks before, we'll hear, you know, how dare all those well-meaning enviros travel halfway around the world for a conference that never does anything? Well, this year it actually did something. But the criterion, I have thought, should be, okay, so for it to be worth its while, does the COP have to trigger emission reductions equal to its footprint, equal to 100 times its footprint, equal to 10,000 times its footprint before it's justified? Let's agree on what that target is, not just for the COP, but for anything. And frankly, for a fossil fuel industry conference, let's also factor in the impact of the business deals they're making in the backrooms. Oh, wait a minute. The fossil industry is making backroom deals at the COP too, aren't they? Okay, well, let's get that into the calculation. It gets a bit nerdy. But if not, not doable.
Listener, thank you for your questions. And all listeners, thank you for all your questions. Please do keep sending them to us. We hope you answered your questions. If we didn't, or you have any follow-ups, please do email us, greenmajority.ca.
So a couple quick things that these were sort of like some of the major stories that have come out of the last month and would love to get your take and some details on them. So the first one is the 413 highway, I won't say debacle, but all of the drama surrounding it. For listeners who have no idea what I mean when I say Highway 413, that is, I believe it's kind of colloquially referred to as the GTA West Corridor. And it's a 400 series highway. And for those of you who aren't in Ontario, the 400 series is like our major highway network that runs from Windsor at the border all the way through to Quebec. And it's the major sort of ground transit corridor for, I would argue, like almost the bulk of the population in so-called Canada. It's hugely busy. It's hugely frequented. Sometimes I'll hear people say things like, oh, it's the busiest highway in the world. I don't know if that's true by volume or by size. But anyway, it's a big deal. And Highway 413 has been proposed since like the early 2000s, I think. It was paused for a bit. It was going to be up for consideration and was going to have to undergo a federal impact assessment. And apparently that is no longer on the table. So yeah, can you brief us, Mitchell, what's happening with 413 and the GTA West Corridor?
Thanks, Laura. And as you say, it was a really big deal when the then Environment Minister, Jonathan Wilkinson, said that 413 would be subject to environmental assessment. The Ford government in Ontario, of course, did not want that to happen. But there are grounds, I think, under the Species at Risk Act and possibly other legislation where a federal review was justified. To put this in perspective, in our coverage of the decision to lift the environmental assessment process, to cancel the environmental assessment, the executive director of Environmental Defense Canada, Tim Gray, said this: Highway 413 is the bulldozer front of farm eating, nature killing, climate warming, developer enriching sprawl that would cost Ontarians billions. Much better city building and transportation alternatives are at our fingertips. That pretty much says it all. And to your question of how this happened, i.e. how this reversal happened at the federal level, I've heard different bits of speculation, and I know you have as well, Lauren. No idea for sure of what's happening. Something that I've wondered, but the fact that I'm wondering this does not make it true, does not make it right. I know that last year, some parts of the Federal Impact Assessment Act were deemed unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of Canada. I know that a review to correct what the court saw as errors in the legislation, that review, as far as I know, is still underway. I don't know whether the 413 review got caught up in that, or whether there was something more to do with just day-to-day politics between the federal government and Ontario. And certainly we'd be very keen to hear from listeners if you have any intel on what's going on there.
So in breaking, non-breaking news, because of course we pre-recorded this show, and so this happened when we pre-recorded it, which is on Monday, but did happen while we were recording the show, hence the beginning of the conversation the two of you just had and me jumping in right now. The feds and the Premier Doug Ford appear to have agreed to move forward on Highway 413. From the read of this, it looks like the feds basically get to be like a little more involved in making sure the species that their jurisdiction is cared for, but there appears to be nothing else in it for those of us who are concerned about the emissions or anything else. So this kind of feels, from the very cursory read of this agreement, and the article does also reference, Mitchell, the Supreme Court ruling on the Impact Assessment Act. And so perhaps that does have more to do with this than we can count. It does look like basically the feds are just rolling over and saying that they will minimize environmental impacts. I'm putting this in scare quotes that no one can see because it's the radio, but they're there and are just allowing the continuation of sprawl and highways, which have been very accurately previously described as Canada, as Ontario's oil sands, because they still move a whole lot of oil down pipelines. It's just the pipelines are highways. And we get one more because the feds decided to let them do it. I know when this happened, we covered on the show that this was actually exciting because it sort of felt like maybe they were going to use this larger consideration. Doesn't look like it's going to happen this time. There we go. If you want to learn more about this information, go check the Energy Mix now, because by now, you're listening to this, it'll be 5 days later, and I'm sure they'll have an excellent report written up about this. So go to theenergymix.com. Yeah, no pressure. You have five days.
We're going to keep moving on. So my second sort of story that we wanted to touch on here is regarding the Federal Housing Act that I believe just launched last week, or was dropped last week. And it sort of posits that generally speaking, the thesis of this new act posits that the housing crisis is due to a shortfall in housing and partially due to restrictive planning processes over the last several decades. And essentially it's aiming to develop a solution to that issue. And at the heart of this solution is building more homes, making it easier to own or rent a home. I'm not too sure exactly what they mean by that. And then trying to build more affordable housing. So essentially scaling up seems to be at the heart of this. Anyway, I won't dig into it because I'm not exactly an expert here, but basically, yeah, in a nutshell, what's going on with this new Federal Housing Act?
So, okay, as you say, a flurry of announcements on affordable housing have been part of this pre-budget tour that the Trudeau government's been on over the last week or a week and a half. They're talking about building 3.9 million new homes by 2031, new affordability measures for first-time buyers, more affordability measures for apartments and for renters. It sounds like there's some kind of bill of rights for renters, more than $1 billion for homelessness, targeted funding for urban Indigenous people, and more housing on public lands, all of it to try to get more housing on the ground. what will be so important, and I'm not sure to what degree these details are out yet from a climate point of view, but through a climate lens and through the lens of a government that recognizes that we're in a climate emergency, it is so important for all of this work, for all of this activity, for all of these projects to have low carbon, net zero carbon, net zero ready, low energy, energy efficient housing as a through line for all of this new construction that's going to take place. We know from the retrofit housing stock that once a building is built, it's with us for a long time. So if we're about to build 3.9 million of them by 2031, and I would do my Dr. Evil imitation, except first of all, this is radio, and secondly, my family tells me I never get it right, but 3.9 million houses, right? We have to get this right, because frankly, we won't have the time and nobody's going to want to put in the resources to retrofit them afterwards. But there's another argument that ties this in with affordability. For decades, not years, in the climate community, so many of us have said, oh, sure, you know, we get that climate change isn't the only issue, which people would pay attention to it. But really, come on, join us. You know, whatever it is that you're about, if you're about affordability, if you're about better health, if you're about protecting nature, you know, come join us. And if we can win this fight on climate change, then solving your problem, solving your issue will be, and we call it a co-benefit of climate action. This is a moment when the emission reductions that we need, the energy savings that we need, can be a co-benefit of what everybody out there really needs. You know, if a household has been spending too many weeks, months, years having to choose between food and fuel, that's going to be the issue that matters to them. And how brutal would anyone be to try to suggest to them otherwise? But what that story also tells us is that it's not just about making the home affordable when it's built. It's about making it affordable to operate. It's making it affordable to live in. You know, and I've heard of people seeing their energy bills fall from hundreds of dollars to tens of dollars per month, thanks to a heat pump. And so if the leading argument to get those heat pumps in and to pick up the pace on heat pump installation, which we need, if the leading argument for that is you'll never again have to choose between food and fuel, we are out to defeat energy poverty once and for all. And that turns out to be a climate message without using any of the regular C words like climate and carbon and crisis, and we still get those emission reductions done. I don't see the problem because we got them done. And that's 3.9 million homes.
Yeah. No, and I mean, there's lots of promise, but a quick cursory glance, and like there are a couple of things that jump out at me and make me kind of nervous, because like you said, it's like we can't afford to build a bunch of apartments with the expectation that they're going to undergo deep retrofits 10 years down the line. A, that's too late. B, that's too expensive. Nobody's going to do that. But I see lines like this under the subheading, if somebody wants to follow along at home, making our programs faster and easier to use, specifically referring to the apartment construction loan program here. And there's a bullet point under here specifically about providing additional flexibility on affordability, energy efficiency, and accessibility requirements. And the use of the term providing flexibility as it pertains to, I'm assuming, the builder in this case, around things like affordability, energy efficiency, and accessibility, like that's all a big red flag for me, because what that indicates is that the regulations that have been put in place in order to make sure these houses are energy efficient, relatively affordable, and safe and accessible for people are going to potentially be a little malleable here and aren't necessarily going to have to be adhered to. So it's, yeah,
that's really worrying.
Great. It is.
Yeah,
really,
and that's really worrying. And also a number of provincial premiers, beginning with Doug Ford in Ontario, will not be terribly inclined, in fact, they're going to be terribly disinclined to maximize the energy and carbon efficiency of this housing. Another aspect of this is the opportunity to go for what's called missing middle density, which is, you know, more housing clustered together, not in, you know, massive 20 and 30 story towers, but with more urban density so that we have less urban sprawl, so that transit systems work better. There are so many positives that are unlocked by getting our density right. And yet it's Doug Ford who's saying, no, we're not going to have fourplexes because people will go nuts. Well, you know, I grew up in one. You know, maybe people will go nuts in favor of it, but the developers who fund Doug Ford won't.
Yeah, no, exactly. Anyway, so well, this is a story that I'm sure we'll hopefully revisit in the coming weeks and months, because it's potentially a big can of worms here. Last thing we're going to chat about before we go to a commercial break. Oh my gosh, who are we? No, a music break. This is community radio. We don't have those things here, unless it's for other shows. But essentially, there's an announcement that came out of Wilkinson, former environment minister, current natural resources minister, Jonathan Wilkinson's office, regarding subsidization for liquid natural gas in BC. And essentially, the pull quote, maybe I'm paraphrasing here, is that Canada won't be subsidizing new liquid natural gas projects, at least in the province of BC. Is this too good to be true?
I haven't seen anything to contradict it yet, which is kind of a backhanded answer because I haven't been following everything. But no, as far as I know, this is the real deal. And there are a number of other announcements or news bites that are piling up that are steadily undercutting the viability of LNG or liquefied natural gas is what that acronym stands for, everyone. We know that the International Energy Agency is projecting that demand for all the fossil fuels, oil, gas, and coal, will reach its peak and then start to decline before the year 2030. So if somebody's building an LNG project now in the hope that it's going to make money for them over the next 20, 25, 30 years, there's an increasing body of evidence that that's not going to happen, that the demand for it just won't be there. And you can find studies that will document that, oh, sure, we'll be increasing our oil and gas demand through the 2050s. But those are increasingly losing credibility, to be a bit backhanded. And the balance of probabilities is that those projects will fail. We are also seeing just in the last couple of weeks that the persistent drought that we were referring to earlier could disrupt oil and gas, natural gas fracking operations in Western Canada. And that's the gas that gets sent to the LNG terminals. And then finally, Prime Minister Trudeau was in Calgary last week telling the oil industry in that instance, that the oil sands industry, that they won't be backing down on the oil and gas emissions cap. So, those two news items plus Wilkinson's announcement, I think, have spanned the last 2 weeks or so. If in some wacky alternate universe, I were proposing to have anything to do with developing an LNG project in BC, I would be pretty nervous right now.
Well, you heard it here, folks. LNG's dead. We're calling it. Not immediately, but we're hearing the death knell.
I have no gift to bring, but I've been down and out. I love.
And this is the segment of the show where we cover the topics that are nearest and dearest to Mitchell's heart. And the first one is, unfortunately, came as a shock to me as someone who has also exists in the climate organizing space and had worked a few times actually with Matt Chapman. But Mitchell, obviously you had a closer relationship. So passing over to you.
Well, I didn't have as close a relationship with Matt as so many people did. And now I'll always regret that. For anybody who didn't know Matthew Chapman in Montreal, he worked at Climate Reality Project Canada, where he was the inspiration behind their local climate hubs and the wildly successful National Climate League, which is an assessment of how different municipalities are doing on a wide range of climate and biodiversity measures. He was one of the founders of the Montreal Climate Coalition, which I learned at his celebration of life last week, is now studied by academics as one of the most effective local organizing efforts around climate change and climate solutions anywhere. Matt was 40, and last month he died suddenly of an undiagnosed heart problem. And the outpouring of grief across the community has been powerful. It hasn't stopped. It's a heartbreaking loss. He was a magnificent human being. He was a spectacular organizer. I've heard a few people say that Matt was somebody that you didn't say no to when he wanted to get something done. But the thing about it was that it wouldn't have occurred to you to say no because you didn't want to, because he wasn't coming and looming at you and saying, okay, we've got to do this now. When Matt asked, sounded like fun. sounded like something positive to do. It sounded like we can make this difference. He was that kind of just brilliant, shining inspiration every single day. And I know that so many of us will miss him so badly. I can't remember the exact phrasing, and I should have looked it up for the show. But on Matt's LinkedIn profile, he basically listed full-time job, full-time dad as his job duty in perpetuity and one of his ways of contributing to the future. And again, being at his celebration of life, just seeing and hearing so much, just, you know, it's the most incredible loss for his family as well, obviously, first and foremost, and then for the rest of us.
Thank you for that, Mitchell, that beautiful eulogy. And thanks to everyone who does this work, because we never know for how long any of us will be here. And so for everyone who's spending their time trying to be the best environmentalist, for moms, dads, parents, guardians, everyone else, thanks for all that you do. So to you, Mitchell, you have some other stories to share with us. So what else is happening?
Well, we have a few other stories to share this week, as we always do. One really exciting one last week was when the European Court of Human Rights, which is the highest human rights court on that continent, ruled that Switzerland has to do a better job of protecting its people from the consequences of the climate emergency. This case had been brought by a group of women in Switzerland who argued that their human rights were being violated by the country's climate program, or lack thereof. Most of the news reports that I saw referred to them specifically as an older women's group, and the court agreed with them. The story that we ran the day after quoted Fraser Thompson, who's a staff lawyer at Echo Justice. Fraser was also the lawyer supporting the 7 youth plaintiffs in Ontario who took the Ontario government to court after the Ford government basically summarily trashed the province's climate program and climate targets in 2018. What Fraser was saying was that it's only a matter of time, and this is a quote, "It's only a matter of time before this question of whether the Charter of Rights and Freedoms can protect us from the climate crisis, before that question makes its way to the Supreme Court of Canada."
And the other point is that judges across jurisdictions read each other's judgments, and there has been, and they're influenced by each other's judgments. And so there's just been an avalanche. I think the number is upwards of 5,000 climate rights cases in different parts of the world. My sense is that more of them are losing than winning, but more of them are starting to win. There have been some really decisive decisions. Let me do that again. There have been some really significant decisions in Europe and a couple in the United States. And the expectation is that influence is going to start making its way into Canadian legal proceedings as well. So we're not there yet, but it was a real milestone last week when the European Court made the decision that it did. The second story last week was that the Science Based Targets Initiative, which is a global body that sets voluntary targets for corporations to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, under major pressure, we gather, from institutions like the Bezos Earth Fund, which is funded primarily by Jeff Bezos, SBTI agreed that they would allow companies to use carbon offsets to cover off the largest part of their carbon emissions. And that is the so-called scope 3 emissions that happen at the point of end use, when somebody's actually using a product. So for oil and gas, scope 3 emissions are more than 80% of the footprint. It's what happens after the product has been extracted, processed, sent down a pipeline, or sent by whatever means, and then it's used by the end user. That can now be covered by carbon offset, could now under SBTI be covered by carbon offsets rather than actual real emission reductions. We could do a whole show on how controversial carbon offsets have been forever, but especially over the last 2 or 3 years, as some of the really horrific greenwashed scams in carbon offsets have become more evident and have received a lot of serious news reporting. But the really interesting news about SBTI is that the decision was made last week, it was announced there was a storm of opposition, including a letter from dozens of their staff calling on the CEO and the board to resign because of what they had decided. And the latest we've heard is that SBTI has walked back the decision. So I don't know that this is over, but certainly it's not going to be anywhere near as clean cut or as cut and dried as they were hoping. And at the moment, they're not getting away with it. A story closer to home is that the Pembina Institute, based in Calgary, released polling that showed that 89% of Canadians are in support of tougher regulations on methane pollution. Methane is the main component of what we call natural gas. It is released by oil and gas operations, either deliberately or it just leaks out. And at the UN climate conference last December, as you know, Lauren, Environment and Climate Minister Stephen Guilbeault announced that Canada would reduce its methane pollution from oil and gas 75% by 2030. So often it's easy for federal officials to make an announcement, or maybe not so easy, but the announcement is just the start, because that's when the fossil industry starts lobbying and pushing back and trying to erode public support for what needs to be done to get greenhouse gas emissions under control. In this case, 89% of Canadians support tougher regulations. And I believe it is 86% want to see better data gathering on methane emissions so that we'll actually know what's going on. It's reached the point now where, from probably not all, but many or most oil and gas companies, the reporting has been so spotty, so inaccurate, that people are launching satellites, whether it's governments or nonprofits, are launching satellites to monitor them because nobody believes the data that they come back with. This research was part of an international study. It was an online poll that reached almost 13,000 people in 17 countries, 754 of them in Canada. And again, the top line, 89% back tougher regulations and 86% agree with more rigorous monitoring. I guess the only other story that we'd be remiss in not mentioning is that there has been a lot of conversation lately about declining direct support for climate action in some of the polling that's been done by organizations within the climate community. That really matters with the federal budget coming up. But as we were saying earlier in the show, so I'll just keep it brief here, if these affordable housing measures and these new housing measures can get past the watering down that Lauren, you were talking about, if we can actually get this program to work as a climate initiative, as well as an affordable housing initiative, then we might find a way of really mobilizing support for emission reductions on the part of people who aren't already inside the bubble of concern about climate change, which I know many of us have been working on and concerned about for a long time.
Yeah, that was some seriously depressing polling and information that came out of, I believe, ReClimate a couple weeks ago.
Yeah,
for listeners who might be interested, if you search up Re, I think it's stylized Re.climate. They have a great website with a lot of great resources and webinars, and they did one a couple weeks ago about sort of this new batch of polling and information that they were gathering about Canadians and how completely understandably as the cost of living rises as we have genocide taking place overseas. It's climate is falling down the sort of list of priorities for folks in this country, and not even just falling down the list, but is unfortunately becoming increasingly polarized. And I think if you'd told us that back in 2010, that in 2024 we were still going back and forth about whether or not climate's an issue, let alone if it's caused by humans, I don't know. I think I would have been in tears. Way back when.
Likewise, but I guess 14 years later, my heretical question about this, and I know it's heretical, is, so if this is where we are, if this is where people are at, our deadlines haven't changed, the urgency is the same, and it's getting worse every day. On top of that, although the specific cost of living and I'll take the genocide into broader just international security and security issues, I haven't heard that any of this that we're dealing with now has been directly or primarily triggered by climate change, but we know that exactly these kinds of impacts are ahead if emissions keep rising. So if we know all of that, then I think the climate community writ large is at a point of decision where, yes, of course, as we're hearing from some of the people behind the study, we have to keep making the case that yes, climate change is real. Yes, it's caused by human activity. But if we can see from our own polling that people are tuning out on that, maybe it's time we find the point of connection that makes sense to people outside the bubble, rather than trying to pull them inside the bubble. First of all, as a matter of basic respect.
Yeah.
But then after that, as a matter of pragmatics, how else are we going to win? And maybe something to close the show on, or maybe gets clipped off at the end if I'm running too long here. I used to imagine that you and I are having a conversation in a coffee shop before the pandemic, okay, when the tables were all too close together and everyone could hear each other's conversations and nobody was supposed to eavesdrop because it was rude, but people still did. And you and I were talking about climate change because what else is there to talk about, right? And we sort of look over to one side and we see somebody who's trying to pretend like they're not listening, but we can see the red rising in their neck. So we know they're getting pretty exercised, and they get up and they come over. They sort of look at each other and they say, look, I know I shouldn't be eavesdropping, but frankly, you people were being kind of loud. And this crap about climate this and crisis that, don't you know that's all just a myth made up by China? You want a real crisis? Let me give you a real crisis. I'm just back from burying my niece. And 2 months ago, it was my grandchild. You want a real crisis? Get off your asses and do something about the opioid crisis. Do something real. You people are so lame. You just make me sick. And he stalks away and we take a deep breath. So a few things are true about that. First of all, don't call us lame. That's not nice. You can call me deaf. That's probably why I was being loud. Don't call people lame. Don't do that. Okay. Secondly, this is all made up, by the way, but I'm sure it's happened to somebody somewhere. Okay. The second thing that's true is his pain is real and unimaginable. And there's nothing he said that's going to change the priorities that you and I wake up with tomorrow morning. So if it doesn't work on us when we're on the receiving end, even though the crisis is real, why do we think it's going to work when we're the ones transmitting? And how does that change our strategy? Doesn't mean we let go of what we know, and it doesn't mean we let go of the science, but we may still need to do more work on how we convey it.
Absolutely. That's a great final thought to end on. Thank you so much, Mitchell, for sitting with us for this hour, going through these stories, providing your analysis and the added context. Really, really always appreciate hearing from you. So folks, you've been listening to The Green Majority, our special monthly edition with Mitchell Beer from The Energy Mix. This is going to be reoccurring every month. So join us back again in a few weeks if Mitchell's the one you want to hear from more than anything else. And again, Mitchell, before we leave, where can folks find you and can find The Energy Mix?
Thank you once again. We are at www.theenergymix.com.
Thank you. Okay, that's perfect. And again, listeners, this has been The Green Majority. My name's Lauren. You also heard from my co-host, Stefan, today. We'll see you next week. And in the meantime, if you want to give us a like or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, if that's where you get your podcast, or give us a follow if you listen to us on Spotify, or simply share the link with a friend, that would be most appreciated. Have a fantastic rest of your day, and we'll see you soon.
Not you.